countries seem to be at a crossroads between their slogans and their actual reality on the ground. The latest paradox comes from a ruling by the European Court of Justice, which says, quote, a ban on religious symbols such as headscarves may be justified by the employer's need to present a neutral image towards customers or to prevent social disputes. So where does that leave the individual freedom and religious freedom that most European countries brag about? Stay with us as we spotlight this issue. Stay tuned, please.
Shock has rippled through the Muslim community after the European Union's highest court ruled that businesses can sack Muslim women for wearing the hijab if they work face-to-face with customers or if the wearing of the religious clothing causes workspace conflicts. The ruling was in response to a case brought by two German Muslim female workers who were asked by their employers not to wear Islamic headscarves while at work.
The decision has been met by claims that it will further fuel Islamophobia at this crucial time when countries in Europe such as France and Austria are already eliminating freedoms for Muslims, supposedly to combat extremism.
In Britain, several religious MPs, including Muslims and a Sikh, chastised the court, labelling the ruling as Islamophobic and deeply flawed. In addition, I spoke with a London-based female Muslim media personality about her fears for the future of Muslims in Europe.
To me, I feel oppressed, to be honest, by this decision. And I feel that I am now limited in my identity and my freedom of rights, freedom of belief, all the values that are actually supposedly meant to be Western, modern. Yes, part of it is a symbol of my faith, but it's so much more if you were to really understand what the hijab actually means or any sort of religious symbol. It is not just coming from one aspect. I think it's really unfair. And it's, again, it is targeting a particular group, especially the Muslim women, because we are the ones that are known to be wearing the headscarf known as the hijab.
Many activists warned that following the niqab ban, European powers would target the hijab next. They were right. But if the battle to protect the hijab is lost, what comes next? Robert Carter, London.
I'd like to welcome my guests to this spotlight, Director of Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, the President of Islamic Society of York Region, Mr. Zafar Bankash out of Toronto, and historian and journalist Brett Yonkers out of Hassan. Thank you both for being with us. Well, let me start this off in Toronto. And Zafar, your take on this overall ruling by the EU court.
It's a very disturbing ruling because Islamophobia has now been given legal cover as well. We know that Islamophobia is widespread throughout Europe. And of course, that was at the social and political level. But now we see that Europe's top court has provided it legal justification. So now the regimes and right-wing extremists that are opposed to Muslims will find more reasons to continue with their extremely oppressive policies. Now you see, here is the contradiction. On the one hand, Europe and the West in general talk about women's rights, women's freedoms, and so on. And here is a situation whereby if women choose to wear the hijab, the Muslim women, of course, then they are being forced not to wear it. So again, there is open hypocrisy, which is borne by Islamophobia and racism, and this is all directed against the Muslims. We also know that, for instance, in Europe, in many parts of Europe, and in particular, for instance, in the Vatican, there are nuns that wear a particular kind of dress, and nobody ever objects to that. But yet here we have a situation whereby they are forcing Muslim women, as was the case in Germany, that two Muslim women are being forced to take off their hijab, otherwise they would not be able to serve their customers. So it seems to me that they are, on the one hand, while talking about women's rights and women's freedoms, they are actually squeezing Muslim women out of the workforce and preventing them from their religious rights and their freedoms. In Europe, people are, according to them, they are free to dress as they like. Now, if Muslim women want to choose the hijab for wearing, then I'm afraid they should have that choice, but they are not being given that choice, and that clearly shows the trajectory of Islamophobia that is taking place in Europe today.
Brett, what do you make of what our guest in Toronto said? Because it is interesting, on the one hand, many of these Western countries talk about women and their freedom and right to basically be whoever they want to be. Yet a Muslim woman seems not to have that right in Europe, at least according to this court's ruling. Your take on this?
This is definitely one of the great ironies that exist in contemporary European society in terms of the way in which modern Europe deals with the significant Islamic community that exists on European soil and has existed for several decades now, of course, all across Western Europe, and has no, of course, no reason to subside or to move away. What is going on now is that under the moniker of this so-called neutrality, that they are basically targeting, indeed, Islamic women. And the great irony here is that Western media and political pundits and politicians, especially of the right wing, are constantly spinning the story about Islamic women, Muslim women being oppressed by their husbands, being oppressed by their fathers before they get married, and by their husbands afterwards, and being treated as inferior within the Islamic community and being in need, quote-unquote, of course, of being liberated by Western values. But then when you go and study the way in which the European powers seek to, quote-unquote, liberate them, are measures with which they de facto drive people even further away from integration and drive women away from the public sphere. If you are going to limit the possibility of female Muslims to wear the hijab, to wear the Islamic religious garb, to wear the headscarf in any form of public office, and now we're talking not just public office but private office. In Germany, we're talking about a child daycare worker and a pharmacy worker, none of which really work in a public office per se, who are now being banned from wearing the hijab in their job. Of course, the question that needs to be asked is, how is this going to help empower Muslim women? How are you going to create this, what the West believes that they want to do, is create these sort of Muslim women who can still be religious, let's say, who can still be Islamic, but who follow this sort of Western liberal feminist agenda, and who can be free to work, who can be free to develop themselves. How are you going to achieve that if you're going to push them out more and more and more? We see this as well. Here in Basically, people want a female hour, one hour a week, and in which only women were allowed to swim. This was immediately destroyed by right-wing politicians as a form of Islamification of society, even though this was not even an Islamic demand only. This was just purely an idea of having a sort of a safe space, a safe area for women to express themselves amongst women and as women. And it was taken away, and this was panned by critics and by right-wing pundits as well. So this is the great irony that we see over and over again, that Muslim women are constantly shunned, they are constantly pushed away from society, even more discriminated, even more than the Muslim men are in many ways. And for some reason, these Western powers, their propaganda, makes it seem like they're doing this for the best interests of women, for the best interests of Muslims, and that it's somehow supposed to be liberating them.
Okay. Well, Zafar, do you think in general there's just an increased effort in Europe to dilute the Muslim identity, especially when dealing with Muslim women wearing hijab? And if you agree to this, why is this the case? What exactly are these entities after? What's the goal?
Well, basically, what this indicates is that the West's so-called soft power appeal has completely failed. It was Europe, as well as this is also, of course, the case in North America. For instance, right here in Canada, in the province of Quebec, they have a law which is called Bill 21, under which women are forbidden, those women that work in public institutions such as government offices and schools, etc., they are forbidden from wearing the hijab. So what this indicates is that the West's so-called soft power appeal to the Muslim women has totally failed. Under the rubric of, for instance, providing them freedom from oppression, liberating them from the clutches of oppressive Muslim husbands, etc., that has not worked with Muslim women, because the entire premise of the West was totally false. When Muslims wear the hijab, it is not because they are being oppressed, but because they see it as a religious obligation and as their identity. So now the West is using coercive powers to force Muslim women from wearing the hijab. So what this is likely to do is, obviously, if Muslim women cannot find work, they are obviously, the Europeans are basically trying to push Muslims out of their society, because they have realized that they cannot dilute the Muslims' identity. And so this is a campaign that is going to obviously affect the Muslims negatively. They are now being targeted economically, because if Muslim women can't work, then naturally it is going to affect their pocketbooks, and at the same time create more alienation among Muslims from these societies. So I'm afraid it clearly indicates that the West's appeal has failed, and now they're indulging in these coercive tactics to try to force Muslims to adopt their way of life.
Well, Brett, I mean, with what Zafar was saying and saying before, basically women were continually being attacked wearing hijab. Basically, Muslim men were blamed for them wearing it, either their husbands or their fathers. But, you know, we're seeing more and more actually Western women even convert to Islam and choose to wear it, and these women born and raised in these countries. And now it seems that these European entities, they're kind of up against the wall, because obviously that rhetoric won't sell. But now they're actually trying to make it illegal. How dangerous is this situation? And why is there such blowback for women who want to choose to be modest?
Well, this is all, of course, part of a constant fear, I think, that these powers that be in the West have, that their hegemonic project that has ruled, of course, much of the world for the past 200 years, is slowly, or actually not so slowly anymore now, it is losing its appeal to much of the world population. And it's losing its appeal, and it's losing its attraction and its power base, even at home itself. And I think Mr. Zafar Mangash indeed referred to this very very well when saying that this soft power is failing, because you see, indeed, you see Muslim women and of younger generation, born and raised here, whose parents were often born and raised here, and who only have a connection to their Muslim so-called country of origin by going two or three or four generations back. These people are often now becoming more attached to their faith than their parents and grandparents ever were. You see more and more young Muslim women starting to wear the hijab. You see, indeed, a lot of converts or reverts starting to wear the hijab as well. And this is becoming something that is more and more commonplace in Europe. And this causes a massive fear among the hegemonic powers, especially in countries such as France, such as Germany, and also to a certain extent, of course, the United Kingdom. These countries that have built themselves completely on the premise of liberalism, on that classical liberal idea in which religion has been pushed to the private sphere of influence, and in which basically the market and the commodification of everything has become a form of new state religion, they feel threatened by the fact that you have more and more Muslims now who are starting to really express their faith out in the open and out in public, and who say that their faith, that our Islamic faith, is not just something private that we do at home, but it's something we carry with us because it's part of who we are. And this is, I think we cannot talk about this without having to go to the basis of what the immigration that brought a lot of Muslims originally in the 1950s, 1960s, and later to Europe. The immigration from the perspective of the Western powers, the idea was to get these people, a lot of whom were Muslims, but not all of them, of course, to get them to come to Europe to work at for very low wages and very dangerous employment, such as working in the coal mines. But the idea was they were going to work here for a couple of years, make the Western countries and their corporations a lot of money and then leave. But what happened, of course, is that a lot of these people stayed because they built up a life here, and they had children, and their children had children. And so what happened is that they built up a society in which you have now 5 million, I believe, Muslims living in Germany. And that was not originally something that the powers in control of the country were planning. And especially now when these people start demanding their rights as full-on citizens of the country in which they reside, especially when you have been born and raised there. So these people are not just asking for equal employment and equal and equal chances, but they're now also rising, of course, into public sphere. They're running for election. They're going to work at the judiciary sector. These are all things that were not the plan, of course, of the liberal and neoconservative rulers that rule in these countries in Europe. Mm-hmm. So they feel incredibly threatened by the fact that a growing group of religious Muslims want their legitimate place and demand their legitimate place as being citizens of Europe while also being religious and dedicated Muslims.
Okay,
and that
stay with me, Greg. I'm limited on time. I want to get Zafar back in on this. What about that, Zafar? You heard what Brett said. I mean, what is it about liberalism? Why does it seem, or those who practice liberalism, that they fear this modesty of Muslim women, or they fear Islam? They see Islam as a threat.
Because they have failed to force the Muslims to adopt the Western way of life. You see, in the West, they are saying that women are free to dress the way they like. But when they talk about that freedom, what they are really talking about is that women are free to expose themselves as much as they like. But they don't allow the same freedom for women to cover themselves. And that terrifies those people because they see that their appeal is not working. That what they had conceived was that these people that come to Western societies, primarily Muslims that would come, that they would be influenced by the so-called liberal values of the West, and they would become exactly like the Western people. Like what, back in 1835, that British Lord Macaulay had said, as they were ruling India, that they were going to establish a system of education whereby they are going to create, the Indians that would speak the English language, their mannerism would be English, their clothes would be English, they would be perfect brown English. Mm-hmm. And of course, they kind of brown Europeans that the powers that be in Europe wanted. But they found that the Muslims that have come into Europe, and indeed in North America, they are maintaining their own identity, that, as Breck pointed out, that, and you asked the question that, many European women that convert to Islam, they adopt the hijab, they put on the hijab because they feel more dignified in that. And that is something that terrifies the liberals, because then they cannot manipulate these people.
Right.
They cannot show the superiority of their value. So that is really what is really scaring them at this time.
Okay. Well, Brett, how can the European court do this when, if we read the EU Constitution, there are several articles which contradict this ruling? I mean, let's start off with Article 10, which says everyone has freedom of religion. Article 11, which says everyone has the right of freedom of expression. I mean, is it logical for the court representing the EU to contradict the EU Constitution?
Well, here is, of course, what they do is sort of conjuring around with vague terms that can be interpreted in a variety of different ways. For example, this European Court of Justice ruling, of course, said that the banning of the hijab is allowed not only as part of a universally enforced policy of neutrality on the work floor, which is, of course, one of the reasons why, as mentioned, the Sikh Member of Parliament in the United Kingdom has also very rightfully complained against this this ruling, because it will also affect the Sikhs, of course. It will also affect the Jews. But this is how they sort of how they cover themselves up, and by saying, like, this is not something that directly targets only the Islamic community. Of course, this is what they claim. The second thing what they do is they cover themselves up even more by saying this can only be done if there is a so-called genuine formality. to the corporation if it causes any conflict with the customers. Again, what does this mean? If a customer that walks in, if one day there is one customer who is a rabid Islamophobe, you have a conflict with the customer. And you could just so technically say that at that point the company would be within its right to suddenly ban a woman who maybe has worked there for years with a hijab to suddenly demand her to take off her hijab or leave the company because of that one customer. And of course, the thirdly is that the European Court of Justice said that this is all still dependent on the national legislation that exists. And that way, again, the European Union, what they often do is they give these sort of, they push the countries in a certain direction, but when push really comes to shove, they can say, well, that is depending on your national legislation. Of course, this will be massively different between France, which has already pushed a very aggressively anti-Islamic agenda over the years, mm-hmm. and, for example, Austria, in which the court recently destroyed a ban of the hijab in primary school because they said this was discriminatory. So this is the way in which they kind of conjure up these terms and conjure up these lingos and these jargons with which they can always pretend that this is not directly targeted at Muslims. Of course, everyone who knows and who goes, who is not, let's say, on the payroll of these European powers and looks at this, knows that we're talking, of course, specifically talking mostly about Muslims, just as when countries want to ban.
Okay, Zafar, let me get Zafar. I'm so sorry, Brett, just about out of time. But Zafar, where is all this going? I mean, as more and more there's an increasing amount of contradictions between Western liberalism rhetoric and the reality, and there seems to be such pushback against Muslims, especially Muslim women, where do you see all this going? Are we talking about more divisive societies, and what does it mean for Muslims in Europe?
Well, I think what this is going to do is to make the Muslims realize that even if they want to integrate into European societies on their own terms, of course, that they would not be allowed to do so. So despite the fact that Muslims were beginning to engage politically in the political process, now I think they will be forced to abandon that route, which I think in the long run, it would be beneficial for Muslims, because Muslims will now begin to think outside the box, outside the political framework that exists, because this political framework has actually rejected the Muslims. Muslims will now be forced to think of alternatives, which is that they need to develop their own identity, their own institutions, and their own political processes within these societies to continue to exist. Okay. Short of these Muslims being thrown out of these societies, that's the only course left to them.
Thank you both for being with me on the Spotlight. Director, Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, and President of the Islamic Society of the York Region, Mr. Zafar Bangash, out of Toronto, and historian and journalist Brett Yonkers, out of Hassad. Thank you both for being with us, and thank you, viewers, for joining me on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Hope to see you next time.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll be discussing the commentary of the 23rd chapter of the Holy Quran, Suratul Mu'minun, or the Believers. Now let's just listen to the related verses and then we'll be back, so stay with us.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
يا أيها الرسل كلوا من الطيبات واعملوا صالحا
Allah said, O messengers, eat from the good foods and work righteousness. Indeed, I, of what you do, am knowing.
Brothers and sisters, the verse under discussion was the 51st verse of the chapter.
يَا أَيُّهَا الرُّسُلُ كُلُوا مِنَ الطَّيِّبَاتِ وَعْمَلُوا صَالِحًا إِنِّي بِمَا تَعْمَلُونَ عَلِيمٌ.
O messengers, eat of the good things and act righteously. Verily, I know best what you do. We said that we have two important principles when we want to eat something: lawfulness and purity. In this regard, Prophet ﷺ has said, "Worship has 70 parts, and the most superior of them is seeking the lawful things." He has also said that whoever travels for obtaining lawful sustenance is like a warrior in the path of Allah. And this shows the utmost importance of lawfulness. The Prophet ﷺ once was asked by Salman Farsi, which deed is the best? He replied, to have faith in Allah and to eat lawful bread. He meant to earn an honest living. So we have to really be careful about lawfulness and unlawfulness of what we eat. The sixth Imam alayhi salam said, the result of unlawful income will become manifest in one's descendants. This is the real effect of lawfulness and unlawfulness of what we eat. Prophet ﷺ has said, when Allah makes something unlawful, its money becomes also unlawful. And when an unlawful morsel enters a servant's body, all the angels in the heavens and the earth will curse him. He has also said, worshipping Allah with eating that which is unlawful is like a building on a sand, or some say like a building on water. So anyway, the phrases in this verse would also be important in arousing in us the sense of thanksgiving for the pure blessings that Almighty Allah has given us. This would in turn exert a profound effect upon our conduct.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly
the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
In summary, this verse identifies three ways to encourage the tendency to do good things. First, the influence of pure and wholesome food on the purity of heart. Second, arousing the sense of thanksgiving in man. And third, drawing attention to the fact that Almighty Allah watches and observes all of us and all of our deeds. إِنِّي بِمَا تَعْمَلُونَ عَلِيمٌ, he says. Verily, I know best what you do. As said before, the Quranic word طَيِّب means anything that is clean and pure. It is the opposite of the word خَبِيث, which means dirty. In the book Mufradat, the author Raghib says, the word طَيِّب originally meant any affair that is pleasant, whether man thinks that he experiences his pleasure through his soul or physical senses or not. In reality, it is experienced only in his soul. In religion, however, it means anything that is clean and lawful. Many verses in the Holy Quran talk about doing good and enjoying what is pure. Here, not only the prophets, but all the believers are also ordered to eat good and lawful food. O you who believe, eat of the good things we have provided you with. يَا أَيُّهَا الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا كُلُوا مِن طَيِّبَاتِ مَا رَزَقْنَاكُمْ. Regarding lawfulness, Prophet ﷺ says, whoever earns his bread only by his hand, Almighty Allah will look at him with mercy and will never chastise him. So, as I mentioned, it's not just the case of different traditions. We have different verses of the Holy Quran also explaining us the true meaning of طيبات. The Holy Quran says that only good words and deeds are near to Allah. إِلَيْهِ يَسْعَدُ الْكَلِمُ الطَّيِّبُ وَالْعَمَلُ الصَّالِحُ يَرْفَعُهُ. Unto him do good words ascend, and the pious deed does he exalt. So, enjoying good things is one of the great blessings bestowed upon man by Allah, and it can also be seen as of the signs of man's superiority over all other creatures. Allah, in the Holy Quran, says, "And indeed, we have honored the children of Adam, and we carried them on the land and the sea, and we provided them with sustenance of the good things, and we preferred them greatly over many of those we created." The Prophet ﷺ reiterates this in a short, meaningful tradition when he says, O people, Allah is clean and accepts nothing save good and pure deeds. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry, in your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets this life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir. Also visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, take care.
Things always worked for me, worry, and that's when faith begins.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 19:20 to 20:20 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Around the world with reporters.
Accusations of a state-led anti-Palestine crackdown in British schools have been proven true following the release of a case study by Muslim advocacy group CAGE, which details not only the shocking treatment of students who expressed their humanitarian support for Palestine during Israel's recent onslaught, but also that school leaders have received diktats from the government.
These shock findings highlight the extent in which the government seems to be prepared to go in order to stamp out criticism of Israel at every avenue. Even young students are being targeted by the scheme, which appears bent on hampering freedom of speech on this particular issue.
Out of the 47 cases documented, censorship tactics included verbal warnings, suspensions, a student being expelled, and even police intervention and a referral to an anti-terrorism agency. While most of the students' activities involves little more than vocalizing support for Palestine, fundraising, and displaying Palestine flags. CAGE representatives expressed great concern at the toxic influence government watchdogs have in the British education system.
The schools happily endorse and welcome expressions of support for the Black Lives Matter movement. They join in campaigns against Islamophobia, against any sort of racism that exists in society and prejudices, but when it comes to issues of Palestine, it's as though they are blindsided, and they very much become extensions of the police and arm of the state. Schools and school leaders have a duty to foster an environment within their schools that is conducive to civic education and to create students which are active citizens in the future. What schools should not be doing is disciplining students for practicing basic empathy and showing solidarity with oppressed people around the globe.
For adult activists, speaking up for Palestine could see your reputation assassinated. But now, even young, aspiring humanitarians could see their futures dashed simply for speaking out. Robert Carter, London.
Following an easing of restrictions in the EU and UK, coronavirus cases across Western Europe are on a sharp upward curve. The Delta variant, first identified in India and which spreads much more easily, is being blamed.
The world is becoming a village, so people travel, it's hard to contain.
See all the people here, and some people are not that careful, I think, so...
One word for me, go to vaccine.
The vast majority of young adults and children in the EU have not been vaccinated. This is why the virus is moving around so quickly, experts say.
In view of the rapid spread of the highly contagious Delta variant that is raising concerns not only in Europe but also around the globe, it is extremely important to vaccinate, as per national recommendations, as many people in Europe as possible.
Economists say the EU simply cannot afford further lockdowns. Economic forecasts for the 27-nation bloc are positive, but there are a lot of unknowns.
We continue to monitor the situation very closely, and in particular, and obviously, we are monitoring the Delta variant.
The fact that protectionist Donald Trump is no longer in the White House offers some economic hope, senior EU officials are indicating.
In terms of our relationships with the US, we have gone from a winter of discontent to a summer of cooperation.
In several EU nations, including Greece, France and Ireland, young people have staged protests, believing they are being forced by governments to take the jab in order to participate in society. We have been getting some views in Belgium.
I mean, it's good that the protest is there, isn't it?
I feel forced to receive something I don't want to receive.
Be vaccinated or not, so you can't force people to do that.
Health authorities in the EU argue it is important that young people do get vaccinated, claiming they may only develop a mild illness initially with COVID-19, but could ultimately go on to suffer from long COVID, which can have life-changing implications. Campaigners say EU leaders are shooting themselves in the foot by not providing more vaccines to less well-off parts of the world. This could lead to new variants that might be resistant to existing vaccines, they warn. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
As angry mobs block roads and clash with the army, the price of the dollar against the Lebanese lira was skyrocketing, hinting a gloomy outlook in the horizon. In an interview Thursday night, Hariri blamed President Aoun for impeding the cabinet formation process and for his resignation.
The group led by the president has decided not to cooperate with Saad Hariri, and all the obstacles that I have faced are because of that group. I did not want to just negotiate while knowing that I cannot form a cabinet, so I resigned because it seemed to me that President Aoun does not want to form a cabinet.
Presidential office slammed Hariri for his comments, declaring that Hariri was, quote, not ready to discuss amendments of any kind and closed the door on any talks. Experts see that Hariri is now launching an internal conflict, using resistance as a scapegoat.
It was obvious that he's preparing for his election campaign, because later in his interview yesterday night, he launched his election campaign by opening fire on the resistance in Lebanon.
Observers see that talk of electoral campaigns will be the main focus in the post-Hariri resignation era.
The Americans, they haven't reached a point to let the solution take place. They are still using the financial crisis as a blackmailing means to try to blackmail the resistance in Lebanon.
The state of despair on the streets of Beirut is a reflection of the general situation.
Everyone knew there would not be a new cabinet. The country has collapsed. If the prime minister wanted to actually form a cabinet, he would go for real negotiations. The result will be death of the people, no electricity, no water, and no fuel. Lebanon has fallen.
All the people need to protest. The rich and the poor are equal now, and all six are facing the same crisis.
They all want a piece of cheese for themselves. If they cannot rule right, they should leave. People are helpless. Hunger knows no religion or sect.
With the socioeconomic crisis quickly escalating, many believe the end result will be a probable demise of the entire political system.
French sources described Hariri's move as cynical self-destruction for the political class. Others considered it the start of an electoral campaign. But one thing all sides agree on is that it puts Lebanon in the face of a chaotic period ahead. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Israel has advanced a major settler building project known as E1. Israel's new prime minister, Naftali Bennett, has relaunched the controversial project for the construction of over 3,412 settler units in the occupied West Bank to connect the largest Israeli settlement of Ma'ale Adumim to the West Jerusalem Al-Quds. The project was first pushed forward by former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Palestinians have slammed the move as seriously dangerous.
Now, as Bennett brings it on the table, it is just to show the settlers that he's better than Netanyahu. He's continued the main strategy and the ideology of the settlements in the West Bank. Netanyahu has been freezing or a little bit slowed down the working in the UN, but they are now pushing it forward. This is a very dangerous colonial project in the West Bank. This will be totally cut off and divided the West Bank between the north and the south. So it's very sensitive, very strategic.
Israeli authorities have been seeking to expel tens of thousands of Palestinian Bedouins to other Palestinian towns since long time ago because the area has been allocated to E1 settlement constructions. This area sits on roughly 15 square kilometers of land northeast of Jerusalem Al-Quds. For years, the Israeli regime has tried to dismantle the Bedouin communities to make way for its massive E1 settlement project in East Jerusalem Al-Quds. The planned Israeli building in E1 would effectively cut the West Bank in half and prevent Palestinian sovereign contiguity between northern and southern West Bank.
The project comes in line with Israel's annexation plan. The new regime in Israel is seeking to disrupt any territorial integrity of a future Palestinian state based on the 1967 borders. To this end, it displaces more Palestinians in violation of all international laws.
Palestinians say that it's very clear that Bennett is even worse than Netanyahu, as he started rapidly to carry out his agenda to expand illegal settlements in the occupied territories even more vigorously.
During Netanyahu's term in office, Israeli-only roads were built as first step in constructing settlements in the controversial E1 zone. Now Bennett has revived the plan and the actual construction for E1. Palestinians warned this project would practically cut the occupied West Bank in half. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
South Africa has been in utter chaos since last Thursday, a day after former President Jacob Zuma handed himself into authorities to serve a 15-month jail term. Zuma was convicted of contempt of court after it defied an order to testify before a judicial commission probing allegations of fraud during his years in office. The former leader's imprisonment sparked protests across much of South Africa. The unrest soon escalated into mayhem. In the past 7 days, more than 800 retail shops and over 200 shopping malls have been looted. Government estimates suggest hundreds of millions of dollars of goods have been purloined or destroyed. That has sparked fears of a looming humanitarian crisis, with authorities warning that parts of South Africa may soon be running short of basic provisions. Analysts believe this could be a further blow to the nation's economy already reeling from the coronavirus pandemic.
What could come out of this, of course, would be even further economic crises in South Africa. Amid this COVID-19 third wave, which has impacted South Africa more than any other country on the African continent.
The South African Army has already deployed thousands of troops to help overstretched police restore order. That proving insufficient, the government has called another 25,000 Army Reserve troops to tackle the emergency. In addition, people in areas worst hit by the violence have taken up arms and formed vigilante groups to protect their neighborhoods. South Africa is experiencing one of its worst crises since the end of apartheid regime in early 1990s. With the former president in prison, high unemployment, and much of the country plagued by crime, it is hard to imagine an easy path back to normalcy.
South Korea has been hit hard by a fourth wave of the COVID-19 pandemic, with new daily cases over 1,000 for the past week. More than 50% of the recent new cases have been the more contagious Delta variant. The government has issued a number of restrictions and guidelines, including banning gatherings of more than two people, other than family, after 6 p.m.
Please refrain from going out or holding social gatherings and abide by the disinfection guidelines wherever you are. Even if you don't have symptoms, please protect yourself and your loved ones by getting tested. We can and must overcome this crisis. The government will do its best.
Baehyung-won and his wife operate a small seafood restaurant in Incheon, just outside of Seoul. He diligently disinfects his restaurant, adhering to social distancing protocols and other government guidelines. He says a lot of businesses in the neighborhood are just hanging on.
The current situation is affecting us tremendously. Up to now, the first to third waves of the coronavirus weren't so bad. But as soon as the fourth wave started, from the first day, the number of customers plunged by 80 to 90%.
As many countries around the world are now opening up, South Korea is under more pressure from a restive public to respond more effectively to the outbreak. Young people have been especially critical, as they will wait months for their shots amid shortages of vaccine supplies. The South Korean government had set a goal of November to achieve herd immunity. Currently, about 12% of the population has been fully vaccinated, while health officials emphasize the importance of the next 2 months in containing the recent wave of infections. Frank Smith, Seoul.
In the UK, number 10 has become the centre of a racism controversy which has sharply escalated following England's crushing defeat to Italy in the Euro 2020 football competition.
I just don't support, you know, people participating in, you know, that type of gesture politics to a certain extent as well.
Started after Home Secretary Priti Patel condemned England players for kneeling in solidarity with the Black Lives Matter movement in the early stages of the competition. And as fans booed the players' gesture, the Prime Minister, who has been accused of holding racist views himself, refused to condemn fans' behaviour. But now, following England's defeat and intense racist abuse black players have received from fans online, Johnson and Patel have tried to hop aboard the anti-racism bandwagon, a move critics condemn.
It's rather ironic that the government are making these statements today when the Runnymede Trust has just published a report saying that they may be in breach of the UN Convention on Racial Discrimination due to systemic racism in this country. And it's got to be said that the government has facilitated that, I think, with the hostile environment. It's criticism of the Black Lives Matter, dismissing the group as run by Marxists. I think that they've really not covered themselves in glory at all.
Additional embarrassments for number 10 as the Football Association has rejected an invitation to an honorary event that was to be held for the England team outside Downing Street this week. And also high-profile football personalities have gone on record and publicly condemned the government for allegedly stoking the flames of racism in the UK. But can this fire ever actually be extinguished? That is the question that's proving very difficult to answer. Robert Carter, London.
On Wednesday in the Italian capital, humanitarian activists gathered outside the Italian parliament to stage a protest against an anti-migration deal between Rome and Tripoli. The protest, dubbed a blindfold to avoid seeing the truth, was called by a number of NGOs ahead of a crucial parliamentary vote on the renewal of the accord. Protesters were saying the deal has been causing suffering to tens of thousands of refugees since its signing in 2017.
Under the deal, Italy helps Libyan maritime authorities to stop boats at sea and return the illegal migrants to detention centers in Libya. At least 50,000 people, including thousands of children, have been returned to the northern African countries so far. However, the condition in Libya is a matter of concern as they face detention and serious abuse, including rape and torture.
I think it's not a problem, unfortunately, only of the Italian government and the country. It's a European problem, and the European policies basically, Europe endorses the Italian initiative.
During the protest, activists read messages of desperation sent by the refugees trapped in war-ravaged Libya. Some refugees have unsuccessfully attempted to cross the Mediterranean up to 3-4 times.
Facciamo finta di non vedere cosa succede.
We keep turning a blind eye to what is happening in Libya. The decision to renew the deal is a shameful display of how far EU governments are prepared to go to keep refugees and migrants from Europe's shores.
C'è una parte della politica italiana.
Here in Italy, some politicians deal with the migrants as if they were enemies at the gates, creating fear among Italians. The other politicians make sure not to create too much discomfort to their electorate.
Some lawmakers who attended the protest also said that an Italian Navy ship docked in Tripoli has even directly coordinated the intercepting activities carried out on the refugee boats by the Libyan Coast Guard. Later on Wednesday, Foreign Minister Luigi Di Maio told the House that Italy will no more fund the Libyan Coast Guard to encourage a management of migrant flows that is more respectful of international norms by Tripoli. Max Civili, Rome.
Bagram Air Base in northern Parwan province was known as the main U.S. military headquarters in Afghanistan over the past 20 years. This is why experts have blamed the U.S. for wasting international aids to Afghanistan by building America's largest military base in the country.
The U.S. has built Bagram military base by wasting international aids that were earmarked for modernization of the Afghan National Army and the country's development. The airbase is now vacated without U.S. achieving its goals.
As this army general says, the U.S. forces informed Afghans of their pullout earlier, but set no exact time for their departure.
Early morning, once we received some rumors that a U.S. army left the Bagram, we increased our intelligence and our reports. We got that, yes, they left the Bagram, and after that we entered to the base and took the all towers and secure inside of the Bagram as well.
After talking to the ANA commander, we headed to former symbol of U.S. military power in Afghanistan, Bagram Air Base. A parking lot is located at one of the four entrances of the air base. The U.S. forces have left many of these vehicles behind. Afghan forces say U.S. forces have disabled the electronic systems of these military vehicles instead of disabling the war machine of Taliban.
Now, Afghan officials said they are going to fix such military vehicles to use them in fighting against terrorism across Afghanistan.
After crossing the entrance gate, we faced a real American town where U.S. forces have spent long nights and days despite failing to achieve their major stated goal that was uprooting terrorism here. Now Afghans are in charge of such mission.
Having control over Bagram helps Afghan forces to effectively manage and launch counter-terrorism operations against terrorist groups.
It seems that the U.S. forces had access to high technology, emergency protection measures and welfare amenities in different parts of this airfield to reduce the level of harm, particularly the psychological harm that was coming from the Afghan war to U.S. forces. For instance, this gas station had been supplying fuel to hundreds of big generators across the airbase. Afghan forces have collected these GEM tools from different GEMs located in Bagram, saying the U.S. forces had access to not only GEMs, but also to cinema and restaurants as well. Despite being equipped with a modern air defense system protecting Bagram Air Base during U.S. military presence here, emergency exitways like this one served as a central part of the base. Meanwhile, there have been hundreds of hideouts like this one built by American troops to protect them against possible Taliban rocket attacks. Visiting residential buildings of the U.S. forces in Bagram is also a need. But the bitter fact is that the Afghan forces even do not have access to the codes of some doors of the residential buildings in Bagram. So they have no way but to use things to keep the doors open. The presence of meal packages, air conditioner systems, refrigerators, microwaves, internet access and TVs that have been left in residential areas by the US forces once again proves that how big difference was and is between a foreign military soldier and an Afghan soldier. There are also many warehouses like this